turn of the helix, he was lower, until we were looking into the canyon at the top of the glider. Only his feet showed from beneath the red canopy, puffed into a gull-wing-like airfoil. "A tremendous performance," I said to the man. One nodded. "The flyingest flying. No noise, no pollution." They drove off down the crest, with me in pursuit, into the canyon and through the village and across the Klickitat to an alfalfa field, where the flyer was swooping in for a hop, skip, and bounce of a landing, toppling over only at the end. It looked like the crazy tumble landing of a goonie bird. We all ran toward him. When we got there, he was still laughing. The pilot, Alba Bartholomew, talking quickly, picked up his glider and carried it out of the field. His kite was a Will's Wing cross-country with a sail of 55-pound Dacron over an aluminum frame. The only instruments were a variometer and altimeter. "Did you see the hawk above you, Al?" one of the men, Garland Wyatt, asked. "Heard him. They stay on your blind side until they dive on you. Glad he wasn't gunning for my face today." The other man, Bob Holliston, asked about the wind. "Not bad, but I couldn't find a warm draft blowing steady." Wyatt said, "That higher wire walker who fell not long ago, Walinda, he used to say the wind was the worst enemy always." "Enemy and friend," Holliston said to me, "are necessary evil. Rising currents make soaring possible. They also make it risky. We fly or die by the same force." "How'd you get started with this?" I asked Bartholomew. "Saw a man on television sailing. I knew then I had to try it, so I bought a glider kit, put it together, and jumped off a hill." "That hill?" I pointed to the high slope he'd just swooped from, pterodactyl style. Everybody laughed. "It's a hang-3 incline. Hang-4 is the ultimate, like Grand Canyon," Bartholomew said. "My first glide was off a hang-0.1 bump."
80-some people died last year hang-gliding," Wyatt said.
"How do you get yourself to make that first leap?" Bartholomew shook his head. "Don't know. Guess I didn't want to waste the couple $100 I'd spent on the kit. I remember being scared out of my brains. Actually, it turned out all right until I landed and mowed down about 20 yards of alfalfa. I was just ridge gliding then, running off a hill and gliding to the bottom. In the air 20 seconds on a good flight, but I took a lot of sled rides in those days, bouncing down hills. What you saw is soaring." Holliston, a contractor who also soared, motioned toward Pitt Hill. "Those cumulus clouds indicate thermal updrafts. Catch a cumi burning hot, and you can almost corkscrew out of the atmosphere. We call it skying out."
"What's it feel like?"
"Hard to describe," Bartholomew said. "Maybe free is the word, or magical. You can't believe you're doing it. I think it's what a bird feels, or Superman. But ridge gliding's different. It's a carnival ride. Zoom, boom."
"You feel like a wounded goose before you take off," Holliston said. "But once the sail fills and you're stable, then it's like you've grown wings. You can't see the kite. All you see is ground or sky."
"Are you scared?"
"Always edgy, until you're airborne, and even a little then. You've got to be a little nervous or you get cocky and careless. Then it's stuff it time."
"It's a balance," Holliston said. "We've got to risk a little more each time to improve and go beyond what we've done in the past. But if we take on too much at once, it could be the last lesson. The problem is we don't always know when we get in over our heads. We've got to trust our gut reactions without giving in to them. That's what's hard."
"Tell me," I said, "what would happen if I got into your glider right now and jumped off Pitt with only a few minutes' instruction?"
"Off Pitt?" Bartholomew shrugged.
"You might live if you made yourself follow natural instincts, but I think you'd get bent up pretty good coming in. That's nearly 1,000 feet up there. About the same as jumping off the observation deck of the Empire State Building."
"I don't think you'd be able to climb or soar because of the turns," Holliston said. "You'd stall in the first turn, and that would be the show. Turns take time to catch on to."
"I learned turning from watching buzzards," Bartholomew said. "I saw how they hesitate on the downwind leg."
"Put it this way," Wyatt said. "Al was the first ever off Pitt, and he'd been gliding 2 years before he tried it.
The launch has to be almost perfect. My first real soaring ended me up in a lake, Bartholomew said, which may have been the safest landing place considering the way I came in. My first 2 years I was banged up a lot, sprained neck, twisted ankles, but I haven't been hurt the last 4 years. Of course, I'm not a real acrobatic type either. I would like to glide off Mount Adams, though. Now, that would be highly interesting. The problem there is severe winds. I'd have to pack my kite 6,000 feet to the top, which is 12,000 feet, and hope the wind was up, but not too up. If I ever think I've got a 50-50 chance of getting off, I'll try it. Watch for it in the newspaper. Dead or alive. That first jump-off pit must have been hellacious. Worse than my first glide. Mountain air is rough, much rougher than California-style ocean gliding. I'd read you've got to have good airspeed to counteract turbulence, so I knew I had to run off the mountain, not just jump. I stood up there a long time, sort of accepting the possibility of whatever. I promised myself I'd run hard. Gliding's not like motorcycling. For us, the more speed, the more safety. I'd read everything there was on gliding, and that wasn't much then. I hoped I'd remember it when I needed it. I saw people watching down on the highway, and I knew I'd have a good audience if I stuffed it. Might as well die in a spectacular crash.
We hate audiences, Holliston said. Damned applause from beautiful girls.
Anyway, I took my run and jumped. My heart got a good rest up there when it stopped beating. My whole body said, how could you do this to us?
The technology was crude then. The glide ratio of early kites was about 3 to 1, 3 feet horizontal for every foot vertical, if you knew what you were doing. Those kites were flying rocks.
This glider, Bartholomew said, has a glide ratio of 10 to 1. 8 years ago it was something for anyone to stay up an hour. Now time aloft depends more on weather and your biceps than on the machine.
How high can you go?
No one knows yet. One pilot did 10,000 feet. But if you don't get a good thermal, you sink about 100 feet a minute. With a long burner, who can say? I've ridden a hot column up 2,000 feet above the Dalles.
2,000 feet hanging onto a piece of Dacron? No parachute?
After 100 feet, it's all the same if you lose it. Except for a new model, parachutes are too heavy and restricting. I wouldn't buy one anyway, because I'd be tempted to try it, and I've never parachuted. Lose my kite, too, if I jumped.
Hang gliders aren't as flimsy as they look, Holliston said. They're stressed for 6 Gs, whereas a Boeing 747 is stressed for 3. Of course, there's some relativity in there.
Wyatt went home, and Bartholomew rolled up the glider and lashed the 20-foot bundle to his pickup. He said, come on back with us.
Holliston rolled his eyes. Trophy time.
Alba Bartholomew lived in Klickitat, a company town of 700 in the narrow vale of the Klickitat River. His little frame house was like the others on the street, except for the windsock blowing on the roof. He worked at the St. Regis sawmill, where he ran a stacker. It wasn't the most interesting of jobs. The mill got much of its timber from the Yakima Reservation, 12 miles north. St. Regis was the reason for Klickitat, and when the Yakima's big ponderosa were gone, people feared the company would pull out and Klickitat would go the way of Liberty Bond. Bartholomew's wife grilled hamburgers, and we sat talking and drinking Olympia in the front yard. At first the topics were technical, wing stress, nose altitudes, load factors. But after we'd eaten and had some more beer, the conversation took a different cast. Maybe it was the tumwater in the beer. Bartholomew drew a sketch of an airfoil. Today, hang gliders are variations of one a man named Francis Rogallo made about 1949, although most of the changes came in the early 70s, after NASA decided not to use them to bring down space capsules. A new technology for a new sport. The Wright brothers started out with hang gliders, but the concept's older, Holliston said. Leonardo da Vinci sketched something that looks like early gliders, 500 years before the idea became a working thing. When I first got into it, Bartholomew said, you almost had to buy a new kite every year just to keep up with the aerodynamic changes. New models were much better and safer. He got out a pamphlet on hang gliding. Man who wrote this is paralyzed now from a crash. He offered that as if he'd told me the man was left-handed.
"If you stay at it long enough, something's bound to go wrong," I said.
"If I flip a coin 99 times and it comes up heads every time, the odds are still 50-50 when I flip the 100th time. Besides, each flight I learn something, and learning makes for safety."
"That's probably true," Holliston said. "But I think the real answer to why we fly is because it's addictive. It's a buzz to put everything on the line. Whenever we go up, we're subconsciously asking the most important question in the world. Asking it real loud. Is this the day I die? You're really pumped up when you come back down. It's great to be up, but afterwards the earth feels so good, and you think how you've gotten away with it one more time. Still, it took me a year of flying before I could relax enough to call soaring a pleasure. Even water's a more natural place for a man than the sky."
"You're not a bird just because you fly like one," Holliston said. "But it seems like you are. There's no compartment around you, so you feel and hear the wind just like the birds. Man's oldest dream."
"You hear the wind when you're in it?"
"You'd better hear it. Otherwise you're into a stall, and it's time for the last thrill. You gauge safety, which is airspeed, by the sound of the wind. It's hard to explain how good it feels to be totally alone up there, where everything depends absolutely on yourself. Until you've felt the freedom of that, and how your senses come alive, you really can't understand soaring."
"Freedom's a misleading word, though, because we're only free as long as we balance gravity and thermals. It's like both sky and earth want us. They're both pulling. We get to fly as long as we keep things balanced. And that's where the sensation is, when we're hanging between up and down. Sometimes it seems like, I don't know," Bartholomew said abstractedly. "Sometimes I just get to thinking I can stay up forever if I can only keep the balance. You can get so outside yourself you start believing you belong in the sky, like you were born up there. That's when it's most dangerous. And the best. You sound like Icarus."
"Of course you never can maintain the balance," Holliston said. "Something always comes along and changes things. Mr. Down gets you every time."
9. I followed the road. The road followed the Klickitat, and the river followed the Rocky Valley down to the Columbia. At the Dalles, another dam. This one wedged between high walls of basalt. Before the rapids here disappeared, Indians caught salmon for a couple of thousand years by spearing them in midair as the fish exploded leaps up the falls. Klickitats smoked the salmon over coals, pulverized the dried flesh, and either packed it in wicker baskets lined with fishskins for use during the winter, or they tied the cooked salmon in bundles for trading to other tribes. The fish kept for months, and some even ended up with Indians living east of the Rockies. The Cascades provided such a rich fishing site that Lewis and Clark called the Dalles the Great Mart of all this country. Natives found a new source of income in the falls when white traders came with boats to be portaged. One fur trader complained, as did many early travelers, that the Indians were friendly but habitual thieves. Yet he paid 50 braves only a quid of tobacco each to carry his heavy boats a mile upriver. East of the dam, the land looked as though someone had drawn a north-south line forbidding green life. West, patches of forest. East, a desert of hills growing only shrubs and dry grasses. The wet coastal country was gone. A little before sunset, in the last long stretch of light, I saw on a great rounded hill hundreds of feet above the river a strange huddle of upright rocks. It looked like Stonehenge. When I got closer, I saw that it was Stonehenge, in perfect repair. I turned off the highway and went down to the bottomland peach groves, where a track up the hill led to the stones. They stood 100 yards south of several collapsed buildings. In truth, the circle of menhirs was a ferro-concrete henge, but it was as arresting on its hill as the real Stonehenge on Salisbury Plain. From it, I could see the river Lewis and Clark had opened the northwest with,
and awakened a new consciousness of nationhood. I could look across to a far riverside section of the Oregon Trail now buried under I-80 North. The setting sun cast an unearthly light on the 16-foot megaliths and turned the enormous pyramid of Mount Hood, 50 miles away, to a black triangle. I felt again the curious fusion of time, past with present, that occurred at the Nevada petroglyphs. A flaking wooden sign said a highway engineer and rail magnate, Sam Hill, whose grave was just down the slope, had built the replica in the 20s as a memorial to doughboys sacrificed to the heathen god of war. Over several smooth declivities in the concrete slabs appeared almost imperceptible notations from other travelers. A.J. Wilson, NYC. Hello, stupid. K.T., 1936. Bob and Janie was here. The monument had become a register, and the scribbles gave a historical authenticity that masked its bogus one. The 20th century had made the stones an equivalent to the petroglyphs. I picked up a peel-away Polaroid negative, the totemic offering of the American tourist. Barely visible was the reversed image of a woman standing against a monolith, her arms upraised, head bent to the left as if in sacrificial posture. She was unclad. A joke. It must have been. But in the half-light from a disappearing sun completing one more day of a 250-million-year circle around the galaxy, the stones looking more and more genuine in the shadows, and a cold stillness dropping onto the desert plateau, the pendulous-breasted woman suggested something more. The hills went dark. The volcano vanished against the black sky. Blue ice stars shone as thick as mottles on a trout. A few lights from Biggs, Oregon, several miles across the river, gleamed off the slick water. The loneliness again. Now I had only the idea of the journey to keep me going. Black Elk says it is in the dark world among the many changing shadows that men get lost. Instead of insight, maybe all a man gets is strength to wander for a while. Maybe the only gift is a chance to inquire, to know nothing for certain. An inheritance of wonder, and nothing more. Stars shone with a clarity beyond anything I could remember. I was looking into, actually seeing, the past. By looking up into the darkness, I was looking into time. The old light from Betelgeuse, 520 light-years away, showed the star that existed when Christopher Columbus was a boy, and the Betelgeuse he saw was the one that burned when Northmen were crossing the Atlantic. For the Betelgeuse of this time, someone else will have to do the looking. The past is for the present for the future. Astronomers say that when telescopes of greater range can be built, ones that can look down the distant curves of the universe billions of light-years away, they might show existence at the time of creation. And if astrophysicists and countless American Indians are correct in believing that a human being is composed of exploded bits of heavenly matter, billions of galactic atoms, then astronomers may behold us all in the stellar winds. They may observe us when we were something else and very much farther away. In a time when men counted only 7 planets, Whitman recognized it. Afar down I see the huge first nothing. I knew I was even there. I waited unseen and always, and slept through the lethargic mist, and took my time. There came a dry rustle in the desert bush, a skunk, rabbit, coyote, I didn't know what. But it pulled me back to Sam Hill's Stonehenge, now just an orbit of shadows. The people who built the British Stonehenge used it as a time machine whereby starlight, the light of the past, could show them a future of equinoxes, solstices, eclipses. Across America, I had been looking for something similar. An old urge in man. It seemed the journey had led here. What was this piece of ground I stood on? 50 miles away rose the ancient volcano like those that puffed out the first atmosphere, and under me lay the volcanic basalt ridge the old river had cut through. For thousands of years, Chinook and Chum and Bluebacks swam upriver to regenerate, and Indians followed after the salmon, and then new people came down the river after everything. South lay the Oregon Trail, under four lanes of concrete marked off by the yellow running lights of the transports. South, too, were glinting rails of the Union Pacific. North, a ghost town, crumbling. And around me, a circle of stones for the dead of the First War called a World War. Astronomer Edwin Hubble observed a galaxy moving away from Earth at 900 million miles an hour and concluded that the universe is dispersing itself to emptiness. Perhaps so, but the things I saw on the mountain, and more that I didn't, all had come together briefly while I stood as witness. Now atomic physicists, those who watched the dance of the universe, were saying that in the pursuit of matter, one ends up not so much with things as with interconnections. Interconnections that give the particularities not merely definition, but even more, their moment, their meaning. Whitman. A vast similitude interlocks all. Who can say how a man comes to see? I appeared surrounded by tombstones. The volcano dead, the basalt solidified, the fast river of cataracts drowned, the Indians and explorers and settlers and 13 doughboys and Sam Hill too, his tombstone said, amid nature's great unrest, he sought rest. All in their graves. That's how a man sees the continuum, by the tracks it leaves. All of those things, rock and men and river, resisted change, resisted the coming as they did the going. Hood warmed and rose slowly, breaking open the plain and cooled slowly over the plain it buried. The nature of things is resistance to change, while the nature of process is resistance to stasis. Yet things and process are one, and the line from inorganic to organic and back again is uninterrupted and unbroken. The ghost dancers showed both man's natural opposition to change he doesn't understand and his natural failure in such opposition. But it is man's potential to try to see how all things come from the old, intense light, and how they pause in the darkness of matter only long enough to change back into energy, to see that changelessness would be meaninglessness, to know that the only way the universe can show and prove itself is through change. His job is to do what nothing else he knows of can do, to look about and draw upon time. A man lives in things, and things are moving. He stands apart in such a temporary way it is hardly worth speaking of. If that perception dims egocentrism, that illusion of what man is, then it also enlarges his self, that multiple yet whole part which he has been, will be, is. Ego, craving distinction, belongs to the narrowness of now, but self, looking for union, belongs to the past and future, to the continuum, to the outside. Of all the visions of the grandfathers, the greatest is this: to seek the high concord, a man looks not deeper within. He reaches farther out. 10. The light spreading slowly that morning came over the hills as if on foot, filling in a hollow here, pushing out a shadow there, working gradually to bring on the colors and forms of day. It bleached the gray eastern sides of the megaliths and rolled a shadow like a great spoked wheel down the scarp. Snow on Mount Hood shifted on the spectrum from yellow to ice white. I walked around what was left of the streets of the ghost town. A stone fountain, a few fire plugs, four rock buildings. A monument out here in the isolation made some sense, but not a town. So I went back up the highway to the Mary Hill Museum of Fine Arts. Made no sense here either, to ask how come. Sam Hill had many plans, some shrewd, some cockamamie, and he had money to try them. His plan for Mary Hill, Washington, first called Columbus, was to find a narrow zone where coastal rains met desert sun. That belt, he believed, would be an agricultural Eden. Early in the century, he decided the Columbia Hills was that place, and laid out a town of 34 city blocks, built a reservoir, and a few buildings. He talked some Belgian Quakers into considering settlement, but when scouts for the group came, they saw and left. To them, Hill's ideal zone was the fiction of a creative road engineer, more adept at theory than practice when it came to agronomy and climatology, and they were right. The town lay in the rain shadow of the Cascades. Hill continued building the big and costly stone manor, often called with some accuracy Mary Hill Castle. At one time he said it was for his wife Mary, but she apparently refused even to visit the place. At various other times he said Mary Hill would be A, a fortress to stop foreign invaders, or B, a cultural center served by his Northern Pacific Railroad running down alongside the Columbia and Cross River from the competing Union Pacific, or C, a universal school for all the people, where farmer folk could find solutions to their problems, or D, an international museum, which it turned out to be, if you consider America and Romania to constitute international. As for the town, Hill finally gave the meeting house to a couple of English women for their years of service in his employ, and they opened the Meadowlark Inn, a place of good food and quiet. But Hill died. The other buildings fell down, the reservoir silted up, the women died, and in 1958 the inn burned. Hill's dream had passed, and now, but for the museum, monument, and the ruined rock walls, the desert slope was as vacant as ever. On the highway again. At a cluster of closed buildings called Roosevelt, I noticed my gas was low. The next town, according to the atlas, was Moonax, 5 miles away. 10 miles on, MacCready. 15, Alderdale. 20, Wickham. I drove, unconcerned. But Moonax was another Liberty Bond. Same with MacCready. Down went the needle. I could see stations along the interstate a mile south across the Bridgeless River. No Alderdale. I locked the speedometer needle on 45 and my arms to the steering wheel. A traveling salesman once told me that if you tense butt muscles tight enough, you can run on an empty tank for miles. And that's what it was going to take. Wickham was there, more or less, but the station was closed on Sundays. Patterson, the last hope. If it proved a ghost town, I was going to learn more about this deleted landscape on foot. I drove, tensed top to bottom, waiting for that sickening silent glide. Of the 171,000 gas stations in the country, I needed one. Patterson, under the Horseheaven Hills, had an open station, where I pumped in a kilderkin of gas. The odds paid off. I told the attendant, a surly fellow who could have raised mushrooms in the organic decay of his front teeth, about looking for Moonax. Two obese women, with faces they might have bought at Kmart, burst out laughing from their aluminum chairs. "Moonax! Moonax! Moonax!" each crowed one after the other. "Moonax," I repeated. I might just as well have said Mongolia. I didn't have the heart to mention MacCready. "You're about 50 years late, Tootsie," one said. "Moonax ain't but a hole in the ground." I climbed into my truck. From the greasy room, somebody said, "Moonax!" and the laughter began again. Maybe I knew about Betelgeuse, but Moonax I didn't know from a hole in the ground. Across the Columbia, at Umatilla, Oregon, and up the great bend of river into country where sage grew taller than men, the highway swung north once more into Washington to join U.S. 12 at New Wallula, a town forced to move when McNary Dam turned a segment of the Columbia into Wallula Lake. Old Wallula was one of those river settlements you can find all over the country that appeared destined to become key cities because of geographical position. Sitting at the confluence of the Walla Walla with the Columbia, and just a few miles downstream from where the Snake and Yakima meet the Big River, Old Wallula was a true joining of waters. The name may be a Nez Perce word, meaning abundant water. Although if you lift your gaze from the rivers, you see desert. Astride the Idaho Gold Rush Trail, Wallula began well. Riverboats, stage lines, railroads, two highways. But money and history came through, paused, and went on. The future passed eastward to Walla Walla, Little Swiftwater, with its many small streams instead of navigable rivers. Outsiders may laugh at the name until they consider the original one, Steptoeville. Walla Walla, a pleasant little city of ivied college buildings, wasn't at all what you'd expect of a town with a name that sounds like baby babble. The road went around the Blue Mountains into the Palouse, one of the most visually striking topographical regions in America. The treeless, rounded hills, shaped by ice and wind and water to a sensuous nudity, were sprouting an intensely green fuzz of winter wheat. These fertile highlands, the steepest American cropland, are so vast and rich, special machinery has been built to work them. 12-wheel, self-leveling tractors and combines that can ride the 30% gradients. Into the Palouse, I took State 126, a graveled and slender and precarious piece of aerial roadway running the hills and grassy chasms with bravado, affording magnificently long views of the undulating land, before dropping once more to U.S. 12 along Pataha Creek. Then over the low mountains and down to a shallow basin where the Clearwater River joins the Snake. All the way, Chakars crouched along their shoulders, only to blast to cover as I approached. A few miles south of the highway, the Snake River came out of 5,000-foot-deep Hell's Canyon, a place as inaccessible as any in the country. North of the road, the river, called by the voyageur La Maudite Rivière Enragée, the accursed Mad River, went back into a canyon 2,000 feet deep and almost as inaccessible. It was as if the Snake, which travels such difficult terrain that explorers proved its true source only in 1970, crawled from underground to see sky before disappearing again. At the east end of the Clearwater Basin lay the twin towns of Clarkston, Washington, and Lewiston, Idaho. Clarkston used to be Jawbone Flats until it became Vineland, then Concord, the grapes, you see. In 1900, the town took the present name to parallel Lewiston across the river. The historical pairing is nice, but give me Jawbone Flats. A few miles upstream on the Clearwater, eastward bound, Lewis and Clark stopped for a meal with the Nez Perce, Clark's favorite tribe. The explorers, trade goods nearly exhausted, had resorted to eating bear grease candles and to cutting off coat buttons to barter for a dog or horse they could butcher when their huntsmen returned empty. But more in demand among Indians than buttons or tobacco was Clark's ability to dress a wound or drain an abscess or soothe a lesion. Clark wrote, "In our present situation, I think it pardonable to continue this deception as a physician, for they will not give us any provisions without compensation in merchandise." After treating one Nez Perce, Clark sat down with the party to eat roasted dog, dried roots, and root bread. He described the meal. While at dinner, an Indian fellow very impertinently threw a half-starved puppy nearly into the plate of Captain Lewis, by way of derision for our eating dogs, and laughed heartily at his own impertinence. Captain Lewis was so provoked at the insolence that he caught the puppy and threw it with great violence at him and struck him in the breast and face, seized his tomahawk, and showed him by sign that if he repeated his insolence, that he would tomahawk him. The fellow withdrew, apparently much mortified, and we continued our dinner without further molestation. Through such combinations of boldness and humanitarianism, and a little magic with friction matches, magnets, and magnifying glasses, Lewis and Clark moved their small group for 26 months through 8,000 miles of wild land, with only the loss of 2 Indians and 1 soldier, apparently to an appendicitis. Lewis almost became a casualty when the half-blood boatman Peter Cruzat mistook him for an elk and shot him in the rump. For 3/4 of a century after the 2 visits by the Corps of Discovery, the Nez Perce did not fight white men, because the captains had conducted the first encounters so well. Lewiston, some residents think, looks like a European mountain town, what with its old brick buildings pressed in the valley. Maybe so, although a yellow pother over it from the potlatch particle board mill on the Clearwater gave it the appearance of a one-industry town anywhere. A potlatch, by the way, was a Northwest Indian ceremonial feast, in which the host either distributed valuable material goods or destroyed his own to prove his wealth. Which conclusion the potlatch company had in mind, I couldn't say. Old U.S. 95, up barren Lewiston Hill, 2,000 feet of grinding steepness, is such a fearsome thing. Travelers often carry an extra pair of undershorts when forced to drive it. Even the engineers of the new route approach the hill most reluctantly, tacking evasively, as if ascent and descent weren't their goal. But once on the summit, the rider sees the highways turn to mere dribbles, trying to gain the great basin below. Above the hill, the land again took on the soft face of the Palouse, fields alternating green wheat with tilled brown fallow. A few trees stood in the deep glens, now going blue in the dusk. Otherwise, the horizon was a smooth concatenation of hills, as fertile as the valleys. When pioneers arrived, they found the Palouse covered with tall bunch grass, which Indians of the plateau wove into huts, baskets, and clothes. The settlers cleared the grass, planted wheat, and reaped huge yields, despite a usual annual rainfall of less than 20 inches. The secret of this land that has never known a crop failure, in addition to good soil, is that 75% of the precipitation occurs between October and April, when it helps most. Now farmers, still reaping harvests double the national average, sow in alternate years and control weed growth during the fallow period so that each crop gets 2 years of moisture. The Palouse is that ideal blend of rain and sun that Sam Hill dreamed of, but looked for in the wrong place.
Part 7. North by Northwest. 1. I spent the night in Hog Heaven, as early settlers called Moscow, Idaho, after they saw the gustatorial excitement pigs got into snorting up camas roots. Although settlers refused to eat the tubers, they were an Indian staple that helped sustain the Lewis and Clark expedition. Citizens later tried to counteract the swinish name by changing it to paradise, but that was much too unbelievable. In 1877, a transplanted Easterner applied for a postal permit under the present name to honor Moscow, Pennsylvania. That ended the silliness. But as best I could tell, many residents, unable to agree whether the last vowel is long or short, don't like the toponym Moscow any better than Hog Heaven. The night before I had left on the trip, I met Fred Tomlins. He and his wife Peggy lived in Moscow. He had said, as people carelessly do, "If you ever get out to our corner, ho ho, give us a call." So I did. Tomlins flew 225 combat missions in the F-100 Super Sabre in Vietnam and received 3 Distinguished Flying Crosses. After his tour, he finished his Air Force itch as a test pilot in Georgia. He moved to northern Idaho, where he tried to earn a living by making wooden toys, but it didn't work out. He talked with several airlines about flying for them, but at 30 he was too old. So Tomlins began studying for a master's degree in wildland recreation management at the University of Idaho. Someone had said the night I met him that he and his wife watched more television, especially game shows, than any two-member family in the country. Tomlins told me privately that was a lie. They had come in third in the district regionals. After breakfast, I called. He suggested we meet for lunch at a new Mexican cafe housed in an old filling station. "Can't remember the name," he said, "but you won't miss it. It's the only gas station on Main serving enchiladas. No margaritas, though." He liked margaritas very much. At Moreno's, we took a table about where the grease pit had been. The owners served a good lunch, but had grown tired of the "get gas" jokes. "How do you like the Palouse?" Tomlin said. "A strange piece of land. Beautiful. Want to fly over it this afternoon?" He was not an indirect man. After his afternoon class, we drove 9 miles out to the airfield at Pullman, Washington. Pullman, home of Washington State University, and Moscow are the U cities. We rented a Cessna 150 and flew southeast toward the lower Snake River Canyon. "I read today that topsoil in the Palouse can be 100 feet deep," I yelled over the engine and wind. "Not true. Up to 200 feet. First farmland in the country to sell for $1,000 an acre." "How do you get 200 feet of topsoil?" "It's not all topsoil in the usual sense, but 3 layers. The first is silt, the second's a lighter soil,
And the third layer is loess. Windblown glacial dust, old topsoil. And absorbent stuff that holds water. Under all that, you've got volcanic rock. Weird, isn't it? Glacier dust over lava.
Much of the time, we were flying so low, I could see the men on tractors plowing stubble under and raising tall spumes of dust. The rigs, riding the high swells of land, looked like smoky ocean freighters. Tomlins pointed at a drove of Appaloosa.
The breed gets its name from the Palouse. Indians invented the Appaloosa and white men discovered it. The strain almost died out after the Nez Perce were forced out of here in the 1870s and the army sold off their horses. But in the 30s, some Anglos started working to save the breed by using pure stock the Nez Perce still had. Lots of Appaloosas now.
The man was a good pilot and didn't mind showing his skill. The horizon tilted on its axis like a teeter-totter. The altimeter needle swung back and forth like a windshield wiper, and my stomach crawled up my throat.
"The thing I like when I'm up here," he said. "You know what it is? Your parachute? Simplicity. Up here, life has just one clear purpose. Get back down. Using the wings and wheels, I'm hoping."
He rolled the Cessna on its side to show me the hills.
"The tan fields are lentils and peas. The Palouse grows 99% of the lentils in this country and 95% of the dry peas. Also a good share of the wheat, which they rotate with the beans."
He flipped a 150 on the other side, and I checked both wings to make sure they had followed after. We were 1,200 feet above the fields, but at least we weren't hanging under 55-pound Dacron.
"Can't believe it," he said. "Not now, anyway. But sometimes I miss Vietnam. Not the war, I'm talking about the flying and how things were clear-cut. Like the work. We all wanted just one major thing, stay alive long enough to get back home."
He locked the right wing in place as we pinwheeled above a silvery barn roof. Around and around, down, down.
"You haven't lost wanting that, have you, Fred?"
We were in a sharp descent.
"Fred?"
"What?"
"Just thinking." "Are you thinking about great things living men do on the ground, like watching tic-tac-toe and drinking margaritas? Things that make life worth living?"
We were still dropping.
"Captain?"
He pulled out and leveled off.
"I'll show you the Snake River Canyon. One of our great rivers, and almost unseen because it's so hidden."
He nosed around toward the setting sun.
"I was just thinking about one Christmas day in Vietnam. Sounds piss poor to tell it, but we were on a bombing run to Laos because Nixon said we couldn't bomb in Nam on Christmas. The napalm cans had been painted like candy canes. On the ADF radio, they were playing Creedence Clearwater singing Rolling Down the River. I sang along all the way."
He looked at the altimeter and pulled the nose up.
"I guess the war was a $130 billion waste, but it was a hell of a time if you lived."
The Cessna went whump, whump when we reached the Snake.
"Normal turbulence over a river,"
he shouted. We were 1,000 feet above the green rim of the gorge and 3,000 feet over the river, a twisted strand of tourmaline.
"Take a good look," Tomlin said. "Next time you see it, it may be a lake. Corps of Engineers has plans for hydroelectric dams all the way from the Columbia through Hell's Canyon and on up. They've already built a couple dozen. Half the river's drowned, and so are a lot of Indian pictographs. Lewiston's 400 miles from the Pacific, and now it's a seaport because of the dams. The Corps' job is to keep free rivers from going to waste. That and to replace every salmon and sturgeon with carp," I said.
We crossed and recrossed the Great Snake, a task virtually impossible on the ground.
"Steamboats used to run this lower section," he said. "Hard to believe when you look into that crooked thing."
We turned back toward Moscow. Later, driving into town, Tomlin said, "I hate going slow. You know what fun is? Fun is flying 10 feet off the ground at Mach 1. He shook his head.
"Oh, well. $20,000 pyramid is on tonight. I'll make it through another day."
2. The thing that finally got my attention was his little aluminum suitcase. Except for the spiritual material consisting mostly of typed testimonials in the satchel, everything he owned was in the aluminum case. But I didn't really see it until later. Early afternoon, overcast, cheerless. A few miles north of Moscow, I saw him hitching. The crosswind pulled his gray beard at a right angle to his face, so that he looked like Curry's painting of John Brown standing before the Kansas tornado. I stopped, and the small man quickly limped up the road with a hobble that reminded me of Porfirio Sanchez. Pushing the aluminum case ahead, he climbed in, smiling, introducing himself. His name was Arthur O. Backe. The O stood for Olaf. He spelled the last name, asked mine, and how to spell it. Now the first question from a hitchhiker never varies. How far are you going? After making certain of spellings, Arthur O'Backey's first question was, do you want a free Bible course? Oh God, not this, I thought. Jesus is coming, he said. Save me, I thought, and started working on a reason to turn back and head the other way. There's little you can do to stop a soul claimsman. Even aluminum siding salesmen run out of words before these guys. He was saying something about God's strategy. I've got nothing against God's strategy, but let's not talk about it now. He looked out the side window. We're coming into the forest, he said. You start to miss trees on the Palouse. And rocks. You don't see rocks or fences much there. He looked over the truck. Do you smoke? I said I didn't. I don't like to ride with smokers. The spirit's moving in you, but never mind that. He pulled out a palm-sized notebook made of two pieces of linoleum. Where did you pick me up? Near Potlatch, Idaho. He wrote that down, making sure of the spelling, then scribbled my name and the year and manufacturer of the van. When I pulled in for gas, he checked his watch and said aloud as he wrote, Fueling stop at Tensid, Idaho. Rain imminent. Would you spell Tensid? I did. How do you know about the rain? My hip? The affliction's good for that. What happened? Car wreck. Rolled off a mountain in a snowstorm. Jesus allowed me to almost get killed to get me into his work. I wasn't up to asking what work he referred to. Tensid is on the Coeur d'Alene Reservation. As a young Indian scrubbed the windshield, Backe leaned out the window. Would you like a free Bible course? The boy never stopped wiping, but he looked in at me. I shrugged. Jesus is coming soon, Backe chirped. The Coeur d'Alene said, faltering, No read white man word. Backe thought for a moment. The Indian finished wiping, and I followed him inside to sign the credit slip. Filling out the form in a precise hand, he said, What's wrong with your buddy? He's okay, just a friendly fellow. That's what they say at the funny farm. Backe and I went up the road. He talked happily about the fields, clouds, his travels. He was 58 years old and a Seventh-day Adventist. Some years ago, he lost in a divorce most of what he owned and had never bothered to gather more. After recuperating from the car wreck, he went on the road to serve Jesus. Several times he said, always softly, My, how we need Jesus. He had a bank account in Southern California and one in Virginia. Otherwise, all his material goods were at his feet or wrapped around him. Where are you going now? I said. To El Salvador. I thought before I spoke. Do you understand we're a couple of 100 miles from the Canadian border and heading due north? Most certainly. I'm stopping off along the way. You're stopping off in British Columbia on the way to El Salvador? No, no. I'm stopping off in Coeur d'Alene tonight on my way to Missoula, Montana. But I have to go to Virginia before I leave the country. Backe knew of an Adventist church in Coeur d'Alene and figured on finding a place for the night there. It began to rain, waving sheets of water the wipers couldn't handle. He took out his notebook to record the weather change and our arrival time. Is Coeur d'Alene hyphenated? I stopped at a gas station for directions to the church, and Backe went into his routine again. Salvation's just around the corner, brother.
The pump man lighted a cigarette and looked helplessly at me to see if it was a joke.
"I'm already done up with the Presbyterians," he said, retreating, watching us carefully as if Backy had said, "Is the safe just around the corner?"
I was getting interested in the way people reacted to the offer of a free Bible course. Whatever the response, Backy's directness unnerved them. "The Lord will get you off that tobacco." The man kept stepping backwards, reaching behind to feel where he was going. I thanked him and drove away.
"Don't think he's ready yet," I said. "Catch him next time through."
Backy took out his pad and noted the station. "Good idea." I stopped again at a supermarket to get bread and fruit for the next day. He bought a can of beans and two bananas. As I fumbled my change, Backy said to the checker, "How's your faith today?" That same uneasy smile.
"Pretty good."
Then quietly,
"I don't know."
She rang up the sale, and I gave no helping shrugs. "Jesus is coming sooner than you realize."
"Maybe I'd better go home and clean house," she mumbled.
The rain had eased when we got to the church, but it was still a wretched night, and I told him I would wait until he found a place. Backy was inside some time. When he came out, the rain had stopped. "I've found a home for the night," he said. "You're included, too."
"I'll stay in my rig, but maybe I could wash up there."
"We're supposed to follow a red pickup truck. He'll be out in a while. The service was slowed by an intoxicated man who's seen his error. He's still on his knees crying."
"They're not going to convert a drunk, are they?"
"No, no. This is just his first step. Let's have something to eat while we wait." He pulled his 12-by-15-inch case onto his lap and opened it. "I have a cheese sandwich and an apple we can share," he said, "and a corn muffin. Students at Walla Walla College gave me the food."
"I've got something here, too."
Backy said grace over the cheese sandwich, then ate quickly, paying attention to his meal.
"Good cheese," he said. "Praise Yahweh."
Then he went at the apple, holding it in both hands, turning it, eating it from end to end the way people eat corn on the cob. He looked up once and smiled.
"This is a sweet apple. I got a lift from a man and he gave it to me. I meet some beautiful people, praise the Lord."
Backy's host tapped on the window, and we followed him to a house so new there wasn't yet a lawn. His wife had recently died, and I think he was lonely, although he seemed a little uneasy about two wayfarers coming into his living room. It was a small, orderly home without a single book visible except a phone directory, Bible, and one called Philosophical Thoughts, which I picked up. A clay bank. The men talked and reached agreement on several points. A. Constantine set us all back in AD 321 by passing a law forcing people to observe the first day of the week instead of the true Sabbath, the seventh day, Saturday. B. Nations are cursed because they won't tithe 10 cents on the dollar, but they can't get away with it much longer. C. Television is a serpent both men were guilty of peeking at. Movie houses are palaces of make-believe, but they weren't guilty here. D. God is a he, not a she. Genesis 1:26-27. Backy, at the request of our host, led a kneeling prayer, during which I suffered the embarrassment of losing my balance in the deep pile shag carpet and having to lunge for the coffee table. Backy asked for strength for us all, and I hoped he wasn't referring to my tumble. 3.
"I sure ate that breakfast," Backy said. "Praise Yahweh."
In some Christians of strong conviction, there is a longing never to be hungry, to have no appetites. But he was one who enjoyed filling the hunger. The morning sun cast bars of light across the road. Backy had offered to ride with me into western Montana as he worked his way toward Missoula.
"I just finished a national tour, something like the one you're on," he said. "The master impressed me to undertake the mission while the rate by Greyhound was still $55 cross-country, unlimited stops."
I felt up to it that morning, so I asked about his work.
"Jesus hitchhikes in me. That's the work. Luke 14:23. I don't know the Bible by numbers. From his breast pocket, he drew a small, limp book marked over in ballpoint, red, green, and blue. Red markings pertained directly to deity, green to man, while blue tended toward the satanic area. Backy held his Bible softly, as if it were alive, and never did he thrust it threateningly. He read, "And the Lord said unto the servant, Go out into the highways and hedges, and compel them to come in, that my house may be filled. Probably 10,000 people have been enrolled by Christ through me in the Voice of Prophecy Bible course."
Enrolled by Christ? Am I talking with Jesus?
You're trying to make me look foolish. That's an easy thing to do. Paul says, "We are fools for Christ's sake." My words are my own. I don't credit myself so much. If we only knew the mind of God, oh my. Tell me how you came to believe. Is it too personal? I was a jack-of-all-trades at Boeing Aircraft in Seattle, Washington. That was before Jesus claimed me, so what happened isn't important now. But my wife left me. I missed her so very much for 3 years. He seemed to lose himself, recollecting. After a few moments, he said, "I wonder how I escaped so long. I guess God looked ahead and saw my service, like with Paul." Backy opened his briefcase and took out one of his personal testimonies, a legal-size, marginless sheet dense with typed words, titled, "A Fateful Night, December 9, 1966, True Story by Arthur Olaf Backy, R.P. "You could keep this and read it," he said with diffidence. "I'm the first to admit I don't know the mechanics of English, don't know how to paragraph." "Why don't you read it aloud as we ride? Start with what R.P. stands for." "Royal Priest? 1 Peter 2:9. He wrote the citation on his testimony and turned to the passage and read, "Ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood," and so on, "that should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." But I've dropped the R.P. now and just use IMV for International Missionary Volunteer. Backy's voice, an unsubstantial contralto, rose as he read his testimony. The nub was this. He had been living alone near Wenatchee, Washington, where he made a little money selling windfall apples. One morning he loaded his Plymouth with so many boxes of windfalls that there was room only for him and a blender he used to make apple and carrot juice. He had become a vegetarian. To make his deliveries, he drove west on U.S. 2 toward Everett. It was snowing in the Cascades. On the west slope of Stevens Pass, he overtook a pickup and lost control on the slippery downgrade. Here is his account. "I slid into the snowbank and crashed through. At that split second, I called upon the name of the Lord for help, to spare my life so I can do the work I'm doing now, missionary work. After rolling over and over down the hillside approximately 200 feet, an old snag about 2 feet through stopped the car. I had no seatbelt on. Maybe if I had had one on, I'd have snapped my neck. And spun it around right side up on an angle, nose down. I felt my hip give. Then I noticed the windshield was missing. No doubt the juicer went through it. Then I squirmed out of the wreckage and crawled onto the hood. I looked up and saw a flashlight up on the road and cried out for help. The man said to hold on an hour or so and he'd get help. I was so happy to be alive. I put my fingers in my mouth to keep them from freezing off. Later they came down the hill with a rope and stretcher and tied me on. They offered me a cigarette, but I told them a Christian doesn't smoke. An ungodly man diggeth up evil, and in his lips there is a burning fire. Proverbs 16:27. Backy began walking again 6 months later with 3 steel screws holding his pelvis together. "I kept my word. I served the Lord full time. I started witnessing in the hospital. Then in California I witnessed to the hippies at Berkeley."
"How do you support yourself?"
"I get a Social Security disability check every month for $218.70. And people like you contribute along the way."
"Does the Adventist Church help out?"
"They send the free Bible courses."
"And you keep moving all the time?"
Sometimes I stop in a place a while. In Virginia, outside Bowling Green, I built a tree temple on I-95. Stayed there about 6 months.
What's a tree temple?
Like a tree house in a pine grove. I build it out